echoed round the hotel, or rather, she had worked hard not to remember it. He had recounted his memories of that day, the same night he had given Karen the scrapbook, pouring them out honestly and surrounded by apologies. How he had gone to identify Lisa's body, and then found himself alone on the beach, weeping so hard no one would come near him. How he had come back to the hotel, horrified by his behaviour and desperate to make up for it. How he had given in too easily when he was told Karen was sleeping and best left. Karen had gone away feeling sorry for her father, but sorrier still for the little girl whose wounds she was afraid she would never completely shake. She had woken almost every morning in the following weeks, replaying the shock of his failure to be the father she needed, the father that Lisa had asked him to be.
Did you tell him that?
No. I gave him the book back and said I was tired and needed to think. I haven't mentioned it, or anything else, since.
I understand why, Karen.
Marcus had been as direct in his responses as ever.
You must have been drained from the reading and the memories.
But I thought you were done with old patterns. Won't more silences just drag you both back to where you were when you started out on this quest? The telephone conversation with Marcus had been snatched and brief, and Karen had hit him with so much information she had wondered part of the way through if she sounded a little mad. By the time she was done, the cost of the call had flown to an unsustainable level. She had gabbled it to a close and left Marcus with barely enough time to offer her anything more than those few words of advice beyond, "I'm here," and "I care." When she eventually let it, his advice had sunk in. Now she was glad she had followed it. Lisa watched her father letting the first-class lounge staff fuss round him. Explaining her feelings of anger and abandonment had been harder than she wanted, although easier than it would have been 6 months earlier. She had planned what she wanted to say so that it wasn't loaded with blame, so she could lay out carefully the mistrust that had grown up around what she had seen as her father's lies and how that had hardened over the years, so she could make him see how the pain that mistrust caused had made her want to hit out, how it still cut deeper than she wanted. She had managed to deliver her speech calmly. Her father had listened with scrupulous care. He had accepted everything and apologized, allowing her to do the same. They had agreed that there was hurt inflicted on both sides, that neither of them had any desire to go forward in the same conflict-fueled way. They had agreed to make a proper effort to be in each other's lives. Andrew now called once a week and asked interested questions about her work. Karen visited him at least every other weekend. They were careful with each other, but they were inching forward, discovering that they were more alike than past resentments had let them see. Lately, they had brought Lisa into their conversations, offering memories of her good days to each other, like new friends, tentatively exchanging gifts. More recently still, Karen had let him ask the occasional question about Marcus. Marcus. In a few hours, she would be back in the same city as him. She had been longing for that for the past 5 months, and now the thought of seeing him made Karen's hands clammy. Andrew was occupied, caught up in some animated discussion about cricket Karen had no interest in. She helped herself to another cup of coffee and took Marcus's latest letter out of her bag. It wasn't easy to speak, with his work shifts and the cost of calls, so letters had remained their main line of communication. Marcus hadn't got much better at writing them. His preference was still for facts, for straightforward exchanges of information that he promised to fill in when I see you. His reactions on paper were far more muted than in person, and he rarely mentioned the presumably difficult conversations he must have had with his father. Sometimes Karen read through the brief pages, wondering what this relationship she hoped was developing between the two of them actually was. If it had been merely a sidebar to her mother's story. And then a line would appear in the middle of a tightly written message,
a sudden tumble of words that suggested what was going through his head might not be so different at all to the dreams that kept flourishing in hers.
I wish I was with you, to hold you.
I hope it's not wrong to think you want that too.
You were brave, and you found her.
A lot of people would have run from what you uncovered, or never dug in the first place.
You are really quite something, Karen Cartwright.
And her favorite, from the letter she was holding, which made her grin every time that she read it.
Promise me you will phone me when you arrive in Berlin, the first minute you can.
I'm counting the days like a schoolboy. You're daydreaming, Karen. They're calling our flight. It's a busy one, apparently, packed with journalists flying out to cover tomorrow's reunification ceremony. I've been asked twice if I'm some kind of writer. It must be the suit. Her father's eyes were twinkling. He looked 10 years younger. Karen grinned. I should take a photo of you and send it to Mrs. Hubbard. Prove to her that my crazy ideas haven't put you into a box like she predicted. He laughed and offered her his arm. Just be grateful you weren't there when I told her I was going with you to Berlin. She was incensed. It was like watching a rather square volcano explode. He grinned so broadly, Karen stopped in her tracks and stared at him. You're not, I mean, with Mrs. Hubbard, are you? His shout of laughter turned heads. No, I can assure you I am not. But
what?
If there was someone else, would you mind? Karen stared at this man who kept revealing new depths every time she thought that she knew him. Was or is? He blushed.
Is. It's early days. But if it develops, I'd like you to meet her.
Of course. Karen handed over their boarding passes and tried not to grin too widely. She was about to ask more when her father shook his head. Okay, I won't pry, I promise. Not yet, anyway. A stewardess handed them both glasses of champagne. Karen noticed Andrew's hand was shaking when he reached for it. Are you nervous about the flight? Tell me you're not feeling ill. He turned away and looked out at the window before he answered.
No, it's neither of those.
If you must know, I'm a little on edge at the thought of meeting Michael again. Karen's shoulders relaxed.
That's understandable.
It has been a long time. Almost 50 years. That still surprises me, you know. How young you all were when it happened. I suppose it won't be easy, digging it all up again. His face, when he turned to her, was so bleak. Karen flinched.
No, Karen. It won't be easy. Not easy at all.
You're learning not to blame me for Lisa dying. What if Michael has only just begun?
It's me. I'm here.
At last. I haven't been able to concentrate all day waiting for you to call. And there it was, the joyful reaction she had hoped for. Father is exhausted from the journey and his first sight of Berlin after so many years. He's gone to bed. There was a pause and then a laugh that gurgled from the telephone wire to her toes. Karen could hardly concentrate on what he was saying for picturing his brown eyes.
So, what are you proposing, Karen Cartwright, to do with your night?
To spend it with you? To be Marcus and Karen again? It was all that she wanted. Given the warmth in his voice and his delight when he answered her call, she wasn't sure why she couldn't quite say it. The hours they had spent on her last trip, wandering through Berlin on holiday from their lives, had been perfect, more romantic than any date deliberately planned to be that way. She must have paused too long. His voice suddenly dropped and grew serious.
Are you still there?
I want to see you, Karen, tonight. Just you. Away from everything that is coming.
Can I do that?
Give him the room number. Don't waste any more time. That, too, was what she wanted, but saying it into a telephone seemed too quick a step. She needed to see his face, that was all, to put the two of them back into place. "We passed a bar on the way here, on the corner of Klugstrasse and Lutzewufer, near the canal. I could meet you there. I could head there now and wait for you." He arrived so fast he must have broken every speed limit. The bar was little more than a cellar, as dark and sparsely populated as the one they had gone into in the east. When Marcus saw the two shots of vodka and the jug of red wine Karen had ordered, he grinned. "No crying tonight, I promise." He clicked his glass to the one she raised. "I don't care if you do. With everything you've learned, you've got good reason." He didn't take his eyes off her as they drank. "Do you want to talk about your mother? Or her letter? We've covered so little of it, and nothing of what you feel." Karen shook her head. He was still watching her. She had to take the plunge. If his page was different to hers, she wanted to know. Before tomorrow, when her father met him and wondered, before she risked her heart any more than she had. Not tonight. "I don't want this to be about anything but us tonight, Marcus. If there is an us." She had poured the wine out, but neither of them had touched it. "If he tells me I've made a mistake and his concern for me is nothing more than friendship, I'm going back on the next plane and Marcus can manage the rest on his own." The silence continued a fraction too long for her shivering nerves. And then Marcus got up and held out his hand. "There will always be an us." She didn't mean to do it, but his face was so serious and his tone so dramatic, she couldn't help herself. She burst out laughing and fell in love when he joined in. "This is your fault. It's the effect you have on me. That sounded so good in my head, and now I've turned into some cliche of a brooding Hollywood hero." He pulled her up. She was in his arms, kissing him. They were outside, kissing each other in the street like teenagers until the cold reminded them that there was a hotel room waiting. "There will be an us now. I swear it." This time, he said it as they fell onto the bed, breath quickening, clothes already half lost. Karen didn't laugh. She held his face close to hers and repeated the same promise. And then he kissed her through to her soul, and there was no going back at all. When she woke, after the few hours of sleep they had finally succumbed to, and he was still lying there, she wanted to cheer. Then she glanced at her watch, and she panicked. "You have to go, before my father comes and catches you. I'm serious. It's gone 7. He'll be up and ready for breakfast, and I'm too old to get raised eyebrows for this." She had to throw the duvet over him. He laughed so loud. "Seriously, Marcus, this is not how I want the two of you to meet. My father is nervous about this afternoon. No, it's more than that. He's afraid." He used that actual word. "About seeing Michael again." She stopped. Part of her wanted to find softer words, but this was Marcus, a man who believed life should be open and direct, and he wouldn't thank her for trying. "He thinks your father might blame him for my mother's death." Marcus looked up from tying his shoes. "I can guarantee you that he won't. He hasn't said much since you told us it would be both of you coming, although him holding his thoughts tight is hardly a surprise. And he's on edge too, although he blames the fuss over reunification. To be honest, I don't quite know how to handle their meeting. If it goes wrong, then the rest of the plan falls apart. I thought I should tell them what I found out about the guard as soon as the greetings are over. What do you think?" Karen nodded. "That could work. I haven't shared any of it with Father yet." "Okay, good. If we treat them like they are still both in this together, maybe they'll act that way. Who knows? Father might see parallels between him and Andrew finally reuniting and Germany's political situation and decide to deliver a lecture, not a judgment." "Your father's on his own if he does." Marcus reached for his jacket. And he has agreed to come here, rather than meet at his flat. To the dreaded West, as he called it. Which, hopefully, he won't do so loudly today and ruin the party. That could be a sign of good intent. Karen's eyes widened. How did you persuade him to break a lifetime of principles and do that? I told him Andrew was much feebler than him and would struggle to travel. What? He ducked as Karen aimed a pillow at him. It worked. For a communist, father is very competitive. To be honest, I thought it would be easier to manage him if he was off home ground. There is a condition, though. Marcus's voice lost its laughing tone. Karen waited. There is a ceremony later today, before tonight's big celebration, to mark the passing of the DDR. I doubt anyone beyond the faithful will notice it's happening, but Father wants to go, and I said I'd go with him. It would mean a lot if you would come too. Karen passed him the wallet he was looking for, wondering how such a simple request could make him look so awkward, but not sure how to ask. The thing is, I've told him about you and me. About how I feel. He's uncertain. A decadent woman from the West isn't what he imagined for me. Not that he called you that, but I've no doubt that, on some level, he thinks it. And then there's the connection with Lisa, and all that stirs up. I just think, if he were there today, at something that's so important to him, and who he is, well, he'd set a lot of store by it. He tailed off, looking younger and more adrift than she'd ever seen him. Karen smiled and startled herself by suddenly feeling tearful. And of course, how could I miss it? Thank you. That makes me happy. I've hopes it will do the same with him. Marcus wrote down the details and kissed her and was halfway out of the door before he turned back and grinned. I should have told you first how I felt, not my father. Is that what you're thinking? Karen laughed. I'm not thinking anything except... You don't need to tell me. I already knew. She blew him a kiss and waved him away before her father came knocking. She knew it would be a while before she had enough composure to go down to breakfast. I already knew. It was the truth. And now there was a new truth to consider. That the words, I love you, didn't matter. What mattered was what she had seen in Marcus's eyes and felt in his kiss. She'd spent years treating the I love you she had always demanded to hear as the Holy Grail, putting more faith in what she heard than in anything else. All the relationships that had crashed down because of her desperation, all the relationships that had failed because once the words were said, or worse, prized out, she no longer cared. And now here she was, in love, and loved, and finally listening, feeling the hurts starting to heal.
You have missed your turning. This is Haus Vogteiplatz. Go back one corner and turn at Markgrafenstrasse. Gendarmenmarkt is only a short distance away from there.
The man waved his arm in the direction from which Karen had just come and walked away. She stared after him, unable to move. Everything he had said after Haus Vogteiplatz fallen into a blur. The dark interior of Richter's Schneiderei and her 17-year-old self standing on the threshold, so hopeful and so naive, flew back more vivid than the bright October day she was currently standing in. Haus Vogteiplatz, Haus Elfman, had stood here. Karen whirled round, convinced if she moved quickly enough, a signboard or a set of ghost letters would reveal themselves over the lintel of one of the narrow buildings. When that didn't work, she had a wild impulse to run from door to door, knocking and shouting out the Elfman name and demanding that someone, somewhere, must remember, must be able to point her to the place where the salon had stood. Karen was at the first corner, hand poised, when she remembered Frau Richter's pleated mouth and folded arms and the shadows that clung to the old woman's disapproving sniff.
She sank down instead on one of a group of iron benches surrounding a fountain in the center of the small square. She didn't want to do this frantic searching anymore. It was foolish to try, doomed to end in failure, and that hollow feeling in the pit of her stomach that she didn't want to make room for anymore. It was 50 years since House Elfman had towered over Berlin's fashion industry. That was another lifetime. In this part of the city, it was another country. She needed her energy for the future now, not the past. Ignoring the pigeons who had immediately come flocking, Karen gazed up at the highest point she could see. A sunburst clock, picked out in faded red and gold on a rooftop, still bearing the traces of what once must have been delicate carvings. My mother must have known that clock in its grander days. She must have sat in the square and listened to the fountain play and watched the light and the clouds dance across the clock's golden hands. Karen tried to picture the Lisa who once would have sat where she sat now, 15 or 16 years old, the daughter of a wealthy fashion house, a young girl filled with dreams. She breathed in slowly, filling her nose and mouth with the woody scent of the bronze and cream chrysanthemums planted round the fountain, and imagined her mother chattering here to her friends. She listened to the water splash, watched a group of sparrows taking a dust bath, and imagined Lisa and Michael trading secrets and squabbling, inhabiting the up-and-down but always so entwined relationship he had described. Although she knew that it couldn't be true, given Berlin's history of war and division, the little square felt untouched, unchangeable. She didn't need a sign. She didn't need proof. The salon had been here. Lisa had been here, happy and hopeful. Karen closed her eyes and let herself feel, and knew that was enough. She walked slowly back down Mordenstrasse, turning where she had been told, taking time to study the narrow buildings with their elegantly arched windows that lined this part of the street. The pavements were far quieter here than the eager bustle she had left behind at the Tiergarten and Potsdamer Platz. Karen was glad of it. With no one else around, she could step back in time and find Lisa, walking a pace in front, lolling a pace behind, running about, and real. She could see the whip of her mother's skirt as she dodged round a corner, hear her laughter chasing through the birdsong. By the time Karen stepped onto the wide, marble-like paving stones that covered the Gendarmenmarkt's large sweep of a square, she felt lighter than she had done in months.
Are you all right? You're a little later than I thought you'd come. You didn't get lost, did you?
There were so few people gathered there, Marcus had spotted her almost at once. Karen shook her head and hugged Lisa closer. Where is everyone? She could see a huddle of figures grouped round the bottom of a flight of steps, which marched up to a classically colonnaded building. Other than that, the vast space, with what looked like a pair of identical churches placed at each end, was deserted.
I thought this was a ceremony.
I imagined it would be busier, more on the scale of what's planned for tonight.
No. Tonight is about something starting, a joining together that people want to bear witness to and be part of. What you see here is the opposite.
Marcus took her hand and led her towards the steps.
This is the diehards of the East coming to mourn. Everyone else has already turned their faces to the West.
His tone was measured, but there was a tightness in his face Karen hadn't seen there before. She wanted to ask him how he felt, what this goodbye meant to him, but he was already steering her towards Michael, who was fixed in position at the side of the building. He was watching them come, standing ramrod straight and dressed in a black overcoat with a cluster of metal ribbons above the breast pocket. There were a handful of other spectators arranged round him. None of them looked younger than 40. The flight of steps he was standing next to was wider than she had first realized. There was space along them for 100 people or more to stand without feeling crowded. There were only 4 figures there, uniformed men in officers' peaked caps, who clustered at the bottom looking oddly small and out of place. There was no one waiting to join them. None of their foreign dignitaries or heads of state Karen knew had flocked to Berlin to witness the reunification ceremony planned for midnight at the Brandenburg Gate.
"Thank you for attending this."
Karen shook the hand Michael stiffly held out.
"Andrew raised no objections to Marcus taking you away?"
"No, of course not. We visited the Reichstag this morning and the gate before it got busy. He was glad to go back to the hotel and..." The rest of her too quick response was lost as a band marched into the square and came to a halt beneath the flagpole, where the DDR's hammer and compass-adorned flag was still flying. The tune they struck up took Karen's breath away. Its melody was so haunting.
"Auferstanden aus Ruinen, rising from the ruins. It is the DDR's national anthem. This is the last time I imagine that we will hear it played."
Michael's voice choked and fell silent. Marcus took his hand and held it while the music swelled. Karen watched the two men standing as one as the ceremony began, joined by a love and respect that overran their differences, and had to rub her eyes. Everyone around them was staring ahead and mouthing the anthem's words. No one was actually singing. The two ranks of soldiers who had followed the band stood stiffly to attention behind a standard bearer. Some saluted, some kept their arms down and looked awkward, some blinked away tears. As the music stopped and silence fell, one of the officers hunched on the steps, walked stiffly forward, and gave a short, muted speech in which the words "comradeship" and "loyalty" featured heavily. No one clapped when he finished. The standard bearer marched his gaudily fringed banner away, its head pointing down. The red and black and gold flag was pulled from its pole in one smooth movement and folded inside out, so its colors no longer showed. The band launched into Das Deutschlandlied, the tune that would now represent the whole of Germany. No one clapped that either. When it was done, the band and the soldiers marched away, and the spectators melted silently after them. Less than 10 minutes had passed, and a country that had stood and birthed generations, who had known nothing else but the DDR for 40 years, was gone. It was one of the saddest things Karen had ever seen.
"This must seem very foolish to you. My need to say farewell to a regime most people would be delighted is over."
Michael was staring away into the distance, his face set in hard lines. Karen wasn't sure how to answer.
"You don't need to apologize."
He turned on her so fast she jumped.
"I am not apologizing. Why would I? I am proud of what this country was. I came out of the war with nothing, no family, no home, nothing but my beliefs in a fairer society. And the DDR nurtured those and nurtured me. I wasn't on the outside here. The tolerant, equal way of life I wanted for the future was what everyone wanted. We had ideals. We cared for each other. We weren't easily bought by trifles the way the West was. Why should I regret being a part of something so pure?"
He sounded so angry, but it was grief. Karen could feel it pouring from him. Her German was strong enough now to understand what Michael said, but she waved Marcus back in case her nerve or her words failed her. If she had any chance of winning Michael's respect, she had to stand up to him and speak from the heart. "You shouldn't. And you have misunderstood me. I was actually feeling that this ceremony didn't feel like enough. This is an ending. A funeral, I suppose. Surely it deserved more marking than this lonely spectacle, whatever your view of the DDR's politics. More than something that felt, I don't know, embarrassed?" Michael's face softened. He finally smiled. Not for the first time that day, Karen felt the prick of tears.
"It seems I owe you a different apology. It appears I have misjudged you."
He paused while the soldiers exited the square. An embarrassment.
That, I am sad to say, is a well-chosen word. That is what the DDR will be in this newly united world. It will pass into history as a relic, a museum piece only remembered as real while its old men and women are still standing. Except for the damage done to so many lives in its name. Marcus was also watching the last soldier go. Those will be raked over and last, no doubt, far longer than the country ever did. The two men stared at each other. Karen knew there was a question Marcus needed to ask but couldn't quite get to. She slipped her hand in his. Do you think that would be a bad thing? That the sins are remembered? She was relieved for his son when Michael answered.
No, Karen, I don't. I think there are men who must be held to account for what following our ideals too rigidly led to. And I think there are people in great need of answers, who deserve every assistance to find them. No matter what you might think of me, after our last meeting, or since you learned what your father and I did. You have taught me the value of that.
He crooked his elbow and held it out to her.
And now this part of the past has been lain to rest. Shall we make a start on our own?
Karen hesitated before taking his arm. My father is afraid that you blame him for Lisa's suicide. Michael nodded as they began to make their way across the square.
Maybe, until I see his face and hear his side of the story. That is true.
The drive to Karen and Andrew's hotel was a subdued one, each of them lost in their own concerns about the forthcoming reunion. Karen had hoped to have a few moments alone with her father to explain what Michael had just witnessed and how saddened it had left him, but Andrew was already waiting in the sofa-stuffed lounge. He was dressed in his tweed suit and had a pot of tea on one side of him and a newspaper folded to the crossword on the other. He had never looked more impossibly English. The introductions and reintroductions were awkward. Hands knocked into each other, stilted greetings became overlaid and muddled as Karen and Marcus rushed in to soften them. Although Karen knew he had been practicing and he was clearer than she expected, Andrew's German was hesitant from lack of use. Michael refused to understand it as well as he could and made a show of turning to Marcus until Marcus threw up his hands and refused to translate what did not need translating. Andrew ordered tea for everyone. Michael insisted on coffee. Karen was beginning to despair of finding any safe or common ground. And then they sat down, and the men's similarities almost overwhelmed her. It wasn't just their appearances, but their manner that meshed. Both were tall, broad-shouldered and strong-featured, and grey hair and ages sharpening and softening had rendered them more of a match than they were in the wedding photograph. Their voices, too, were an echo of each other, the tone in each deep and thoughtful and better tuned to serious conversation than light-hearted amusement. And they both caught the same look in their eye when Lisa was mentioned, warm and wistful and sad. You never kept in touch? As Karen intended, the question cut through the start of a potentially awkward silence and took both men by surprise. No, it was her father who answered. We never had any understanding that we would. Beyond one letter to say that we had safely arrived in England. I don't think I ever considered it. He paused. Karen watched him choosing his words, picking his way through a language he hadn't spoken properly in years, but was determined not to be defeated by.
With hindsight, I would say that was deliberate, wouldn't you, Michael? Neither of us wanting to play any more part in the other's life than we already had.
Michael nodded.
With you, yes. I did, however, write to Lisa, although not as regularly as I would have liked. It wasn't easy, especially when Western intransigence forced Russia to blockade Berlin in 1948 and cut it off from the rest of the world. But once that was lifted, I did my best to stay in touch. Did she show you my letters? Or tell you about them?
Andrew shook his head. Michael sighed. It sounded as if he was letting go of a long-held hope.
Then it is as I feared. My letters meant nothing to her. She never wrote back to any of them. I convinced myself at first that, because I moved around so much in the first years after you left, her replies didn't reach me. Then there was no answer to the card I sent in 1953 with a permanent address, and I couldn't fool myself any longer that she cared. I stopped writing after that.
Andrew refilled his cup.
I may have had a hand in her silence. I encouraged her to leave her life in Germany behind. I didn't necessarily include you in that, but...
You're not sorry if that's how she took it.
Andrew shrugged.
It's not as if remembering did her any good, so, no. I'm not sorry at all.
Karen watched with increasing unease as the two men circled each other. They were both so stubborn, both so determined to prove that they had cared for Lisa the best. She didn't want the meeting to fall apart before she outlined her plan for the rest of the trip, but she had a nasty feeling that's where it was heading. She glanced over at Marcus, who nodded and interrupted in time to stop Michael from snapping back.
It might not have been your influence, Mr. Cartwright, that stopped her writing. It could have been guilt or fear.
Michael's tightly contained anger shifted from Andrew to his son.
What are you talking about?
Marcus turned to his father, speaking slowly enough so that Andrew could keep up, waiting if Karen needed to help him, and continued as if he hadn't registered Michael's sharpening tone.
Karen has told me about the problems Lisa was having in the last years of her life. We haven't had time to discuss those yet. But I understand a fear of being caught runs through the scrapbook she kept, as well as guilt for a number of things she saw herself as responsible for. Some of her crimes make more sense than others, but the events surrounding the guard's death were chief among them. Perhaps she felt she had left you in too much danger. You were, after all, the one on the ground if anything came to light. Perhaps staying in contact was simply too much for her.
Marcus might be right.
To Karen's relief, her father's voice had lost its combative edge. He rubbed his eyes and coughed, and his tone grew softer.
She missed you, Michael.
If she got your letters, they would have meant a great deal to her. She used to mention you sometimes after Karen was born and wonder if you were all right. It occurred to me then that I should try to find you, but I didn't know how. I knew nothing about the postcard until Karen uncovered it. Lisa could easily have forgotten she had it.
He stopped suddenly and then sat up straighter.
I'm sorry, Michael. I owed you more. The truth is, I was afraid that one day, despite what she decided when the body was found, that she would leave me and choose you. I was afraid of that my whole marriage.
He slumped back as he finished, as if the confession had winded him. Michael stumbled as he started to speak. Karen gripped Marcus's hand to stop him trying to find Michael's words for him. When he recovered himself, Michael's voice was as soft as Andrew's.
You are so wrong. She wouldn't have. She never could have. You heard her say it. When Lisa looked at me, all she saw was Lottie's shadow. It hurt beyond words to hear that, but I had no doubt she meant it. She chose you. And that was the right thing. The only chance of happiness, the only chance of safety Lisa had, lay in marrying you.
Andrew was already shaking his head. Karen repeated Michael's words in English in case Andrew hadn't fully followed them, but it was clear that wasn't the problem. He understood what Michael had said, but he wouldn't accept it. Karen couldn't bear to see them both trapped in a loop of guilt and denial. She turned to Marcus.
Tell them what you know.
He jumped straight in on her cue with the facts.
There was an investigation into the murder. His directness snapped Andrew and Michael out of the fog that was circling them, exactly as Karen had hoped. Their heads shot up as if they were pulled by the same string. Marcus turned to his father.
The original article that you kept about the body being recovered was from the Berliner Morgenpost. I went to their offices and had a dig in their archives. There were more reports filed than the one you kept.
You never saw any of them?
No.
It was clear from the shock on Michael's face that he was telling the truth.
Once Lisa left, I threw myself into my work. I was writing then, and I was more and more in the Russian sector of Berlin, more immersed in the doctrines that eventually split the East off from the West in 1949. A newspaper like that would have quickly slipped off my radar, and the papers I did read wouldn't have mentioned the death of a Nazi unless there was a specific link to Russia or the communist struggle.
He shrugged.
I have lived my life in a narrow world, Marcus. I am too old to apologize for it.
I don't need you to. All that matters is that you both know the truth now.
They identified the guard, then. I assume it was from the scar on her hand.
Her father sounded so tired, Karen slipped her fingers through his and squeezed them.
Marcus nodded.
Yes. From what I could gather, it took almost 6 weeks in the end to get the post-mortem done and marry up the body with the missing persons report. Her name was Hilda Grief. She was 34. She had lived her whole life in Fürstenberg. There was nothing special about her, except where she chose to work, and half the town, if the paper is to be believed, found employment in the camp the same as her. At first, her husband raised the roof and demanded her killer be found and brought to justice. Then he went quiet, and that's when the Morgenpost got interested. It didn't take them long to discover she had been a guard, especially as the Ravensbrück trial was still going on. They managed to unearth a picture of her in her uniform. It jogged memories. Someone remembered Lottie. Then the thing we were most afraid of happened.
Karen wasn't sure which man said it.
Marcus corrected himself quickly.
Yes, but it wasn't as clear-cut as I made it sound. Someone remembered a child being murdered by the lake, but no one remembered the name and the dates were hazy.
But the paper ran the story packed full of outrage, and if Lisa had been in Berlin and seen it,
she might have panicked and confessed.
Michael was poised on the edge of his seat, staring at Andrew.
We did the right thing, getting her away. You realize this proves it. Whatever the outcome, your instincts were correct.
Karen and Marcus sat back as Andrew nodded.
Thank God. Thank God. I was never sure. I was always worried it was only my own interests I was serving.
The mood between the two men shifted. Michael reached out his hand.
Andrew grasped it.
They sat in silence, heads down, hands clasped, as still as if they were carved from stone. When Marcus continued talking, his voice was thick.
After that disclosure, the investigation into Grief's killing seems to have faded away. The last report I could find simply said there were no leads. I doubt anyone had the appetite for it. Justice had, after all, been served, and against the right person. The trial ended there.
Thank you. They loosened their hands and separated back out into Andrew and Michael. Marcus nodded to Karen, who struggled to steady her voice.
So, now you know. You helped her as much as you could.
You saved her, and yourselves, which I imagine is what Lisa intended.
That's what I want to hold on to. Not where it led. It's what we all need to hold on to.
And so, we thought, Marcus and I, that perhaps it was time for Lisa and Lottie's story to have an ending. For us, at least.
We thought, if it's something you both feel up to,
that we would like to visit the camp. She left a pause for them to voice their objections, but neither man took it. The site is in quite a state, apparently, and the Russian authorities who took it over after Germany's partition are reluctant to let anyone in. They're afraid of attracting fascist sympathisers, I suppose, for want of a better word, and they still have soldiers based there. But Marcus, well, he used your name, Michael, and managed to get permission for us to have some degree of access. And he's found a woman, an ex-inmate, who will meet us there and act as our guide. We could all go together, the day after tomorrow, and say our goodbyes, if you thought that might be helpful. She trailed away. Michael and Andrew were so silent she couldn't read their reaction.
It's a good plan, Karen. A kind and thoughtful one. I can see why my son is so taken with you.
Michael smiled as she blushed.
It would help me. And I imagine you?
He turned to Andrew, who nodded and took Karen's hand again.
Good.
Michael sat up, clapped hands, and changed back into the Michael Karen knew.
And now it's time for you two to go.
What do you mean? The abrupt change of tone from thanks to dismissal wrong-footed Marcus. Karen, who was slightly giddy with relief at how well, in the end, the reunion had gone, struggled not to laugh at his indignant frown. Michael completely ignored it.
This has been a day of revelations that need digesting. Right now, Andrew and I have years to catch up on and conversations which require only us. Berlin is celebrating. You should be out there with it, grabbing hold of your future.
But what about you? How will you get home?
It was Andrew's turn to adopt Michael's dismissive tone.
What? Don't you think a soldier and a resistance fighter can organize their way around dinner and transport? Or a night of fireworks and a party, if that's what we decide?
He grinned as Marcus blustered.
Go on, do as Michael says, the pair of you. Let he and I be as young or old together tonight as we choose.
Karen pulled Marcus up. They're done with us. And they seem to be understanding each other just fine now. We should run before they change their minds and make us listen to them reminiscing. She blew kisses at their smiling fathers and dragged Marcus out of the hotel before he could argue. Michael was right. It was time to grab hold of the future she knew was there waiting. It was dark outside, the cold air already thick with the dry, sulfur-edged smoke of the fireworks blooming in pinks and blues and greens across the black velvet sky. Crowds had begun streaming across the river, making their way to the Brandenburg Gate, although there were still hours to go before the Liberty Bell would toll and Berlin would be pronounced whole again. Karen and Marcus were immediately swallowed by a laughing group. People were draped in the black, red and gold flag that now represented all of them. Some of them, Karen noticed, wearing theirs like a cape, their heads sticking through where the DDR symbol had once been. The contrast between the scene unfolding on what, for the next few hours at least, was still the West, and the ceremony Karen had witnessed in the East was so pronounced, she shivered and pressed close into Marcus's side.
Do you think reunification will be as good as everyone hopes?
No. It will be better, and it will be worse. But it is here. And I'm young enough to be glad of it.
He grinned down at her.
The wall has come down and opened doors I never expected to walk through. I could move to the West Side, study psychology in the way I always wanted to, collect on a dream or two.
Opening doors and collecting on dreams. It was her turn.
I could come here too. My firm is opening an office in Berlin. They'd like me to head it.
He stopped, his grin so wide his eyes disappeared into crinkles and swept her into his arms. Karen laughed as her feet left the floor.
Are you ready for this?
His answer was almost lost to the whooping crowd and the music blaring in competition from the windows around them. Almost. But not quite.
For all of it,
Karen Cartwright, for all of it.
Chapter 19. Karen. Ravensbrück Concentration Camp, October 1990. The drive from Berlin to Fürstenberg took almost 2 hours. Michael provided a running commentary on the mechanics of the DDR for most of it. The crumbling, increasingly potholed roads Marcus kept cursing were intended for military and agricultural use, not idle day-trippers, and therefore could not be held to Marcus's ill-informed notions of higher Western standards. The great swathes of farmland, which were 10 times the size of anything Karen had ever encountered in England, were collectives and models of production the West could learn from. Nobody really listened. Everybody humoured him. As they grew nearer their destination, however, and the bleak, machinery-dotted landscape gave way to thick woodlands wound through with rivers and lakes, even Michael grew silent. The canopy of trees which danced above them in sun-soaked shades of green and gold was too lovely to be comfortable, given the horrors it had sheltered. That must be the town. We could stop here for coffee and a break if anyone needs it. Karen pointed to a narrow spire poking out from the forest and a line of sloping red tile and moss-covered roofs. As more wood-framed buildings popped up between the trees, she had to stop herself from saying how sleepy and charming storybook pretty it was. Andrews. It should look more ashamed. Better summed up everyone's feelings. No one wanted to linger. Late morning hunger pangs were forgotten. They drove on in silence, exiting the town along a cobbled road that rattled through the car's flimsy chassis and into their bones. There was no signpost for Ravensbrück anywhere along the route, although Karen kept twisting about to find one. In the end, Marcus had to beg her to sit still. This is the right way, past the railway station. Ilse said we just keep driving, that you stumble on the camp rather than see it. Put it like she did, the Nazis preferred secrecy, and that suited the town. Ilse Newman, the woman who had survived 3 years in the camp. Marcus hadn't stopped talking about her since a colleague had heard about the proposed Ravensbrück trip and arranged a meeting. Formidable was the main word he had used. Karen pictured a fierce, warrior-looking woman, with more than a touch of the Amazon about her, the one waiting as they parked the car opposite the high wall and the firmly closed gates, was small and wiry and wearing tweeds not unlike Andrew's. When she walked over to introduce herself, Karen couldn't help but notice Ilse had a pronounced limp. Which one of you is Michael Wassermann? Ilse's gaze swept over Michael and Andrew as if she was inspecting a cohort of rather disappointing troops. Both men straightened. Michael stepped forward as if he was about to salute. Ilse didn't waste time letting him speak.
Good. Well, it's your name that got you all in here, so you'd best come with me and calm down the Russian.
She nodded briefly to the others and crossed back to the gates, beckoning Michael to follow her. From where she was standing, Karen could see the fringes of the lake. She turned away, refused to follow her desperate impulse to run to it. They had all promised each other that they would go there together, that it would be the last thing they would do here. Karen knew if she thought about her mother standing by the water, about the guard stepping forward and seizing Lottie, her knees would buckle. She focused instead on the gates where Ilse was deep in conversation with a soldier who looked like he should have still been in school. Whatever was said worked. Hands were clasped, backs were slapped, and the gates were opened. The soldier gestured the rest of the party over to join Ilse and Michael and drifted away. Karen crossed the road quickly, Marcus and her father trotting behind, and followed Ilse inside, avoiding the broken tree stumps and roots crawling round the outer wall's edges. The sight that met her as they passed through the heavy metal gates was nothing like she expected, and brought her to an abrupt halt. The space they were standing in was sprawling and desolate, half of it covered in cracked concrete, half of it overgrown in a tangle of weeds.
I thought there would be buildings.
the same as I've seen in pictures of the other camps. Lots of prison blocks laid out like army barracks.
Ilsa shook her head.
There was once. When I was put in here, there were dozens of them fanned out along both sides of a wide road, bordered, for some reason, that no one ever understood, with beds full of red flowers. But the Russians turned the site into a tank base in the 1950s and smashed everything down. Where we're standing now was once the parade ground, where they did roll calls and their never-ending selections. Where most of us started and finished, if you like.
My mother was Jewish, which makes me Jewish too.
That realization had never hit Karen before, but now she couldn't escape it. What Ilsa was describing could have happened to her, but for a trick of time, it could be her standing in this frozen square, waiting to find out if her death would be quick or drawn out. Karen blinked at the realization of how real it all was, of how the lives that had ended and endured here mattered and deserved to be told. Behind her, one of the men sniffed and turned it into a cough. Her own eyes were so dry they were stinging. How many women were brought in here? Ilsa began leading them further inside, pointing out where the main barrack blocks had been as they went.
In total, over the whole war? Well, I'm not sure anyone knows that number for certain. I've heard 100,000 mentioned, but since the Soviets took charge, no one has really investigated, and there's been no records released that I know of. All I know is that the number who survived is far lower than the number who came in, and that we came from all over Europe, France, Germany, Poland, Russia, even a handful from England. So many different languages, add in the Romanese and all the different dialects, and this place was a veritable Tower of Babel.
Who was in here? Was it mostly Jews?
Ilsa shrugged.
There were some. More at the start, or so I was told, but the guards rinsed them out pretty quickly. We were all sorts, Jews, communists, gypsies, lesbians, prostitutes, Russian female soldiers, every flavour of affront to womanhood you could find. I suppose that the only thing we had in common, apart from being women, was that the Nazis considered us deviants and surplus to requirements in their new vision of Germany. And we got caught.
Ilsa smiled. There was no humour in it. She gestured to a pile of broken masonry covered in weeds.
This is where the ovens were. I came in as a communist. If they'd known I was also a Jew, I'd have been straight in here.
Karen couldn't think of a single reasonable response. When her father spoke up, she was glad to hear another voice, although his wavered as thin as the sparse grass dotting the concrete.
Would my wife have suffered?
As far as we know, she was only in this place for a couple of weeks at the end of the war. We know about the selections and the gas chambers. There's been rumours about medical experiments. So I'm wondering if she would have suffered here, as much as the women like you did who were forced to cope with it longer.
He glanced down at Ilse's crooked leg, who were cruelly treated. There was a silence. Karen desperately wanted Ilsa to answer with a simple no, and knew that she wouldn't.
I don't know how to answer that. How you think I can measure it? Does a week leave fewer scars than a month? Than a year? Is a short exposure to horror worse than a long one you somehow adjust to?
This place was hell. There is no other word for it. No one walks through hell and comes away without burns.
We suffered. All of us.
But you know that. Or you wouldn't be here, looking for the parts of your wife you never quite knew.
There was a pause. Ilsa looked away from them.
Some suffered and died here. Some were set free. I doubt there is anyone who has escaped.
Who still escapes?
The suffering.
What do you mean? Ilsa turned round and finally looked Karen full in the face, rather than flinging her comments back at the group.
Some of the pain is easier to spot. With your mother, perhaps, you can trace it in the choice that she made. For others,
The pain is more silent, but it's still there. No one talks, you see. No one remembers. There is a memorial here, at the lake. It is beautiful. But it is a Russian memorial. For their women. For communist martyrs. A very specific thing. The rest of us are forgotten. Scattered. Voiceless. Unheard. Most of us can't even find each other. We live with our nightmares. And we live with the shame of what this place did to us. What it brought us down to. It is as I said. Whoever we have become, we live lives still shadowed by what happened to us here. Karen expected to hear pain in Ilse's voice. The weariness in it was worse. What do you want? What, if anything, could help you? For the first time since they had arrived, Ilse's tough manner let in a degree of warmth as she answered Karen's halting question. No one has ever asked me that. She bent down and picked up a piece of the rubble. We were brought together by a place. Now we need different places to find our stories in. To be remembered in. Karen nodded, her mind whirling with thoughts it was impossible to voice. No one had any more questions after that. Andrew and Michael, Karen could see, were worn out. Marcus was hovering around them, taking elbows when they reached rough ground, whispering words of encouragement when the old men faltered. Ilse led them back out of the camp and onto the lake shore to where the Russian memorial stood. It was, as she had said, heartbreakingly beautiful. A bone-thin woman stood on a plinth, her head held up towards the heavens, cradling the broken body of a second woman, who was visibly nearer to death, in her arms. Ilse offered to tell them the statue's story. No one wanted it. They all had their own version. As Ilse stepped back, the four of them formed into a line looking out over the lake and its long-buried secrets. No one spoke. There was no longer any need. One by one, they kissed the two white roses they had each carried from the car. One for Lisa, one for Lottie. One by one, they threw the flowers out over the calm water. There was no splash. There was no spray. Each rose landed gently on the surface, as perfect in their beauty as the love that they carried. Epilogue. Berlin. September 2001. We need places to find our stories in, to be remembered in. Karen watched the sun play across the sleek, silver walls of Berlin's newly completed Jewish museum. This is one. More are coming.
It's really big. Did you build the whole thing?
Karen realized Lottie was tugging at her hand and switched her attention off the museum and onto her daughter. No, monkey. I was a small part of a very big team. Come on, let's go inside. There's something special Daddy and I want to show you before the museum opens to everyone else tomorrow and gets really busy. She smiled at Marcus, who swept the little girl into his arms and followed Karen's lead through the huge entrance hall and down to the lower floors and the main exhibition galleries. There we are. She didn't need to point it out. Lottie had already wriggled out of her father's arms and flown straight to the display case, whose contents shone like a beacon, even though the main lights weren't yet on. By the time Karen and Marcus caught up with her, Lottie's nose and hands were pressed against the glass.
Isn't it beautiful?
Lottie nodded, but she didn't turn round. The dress that had mesmerized the little girl was cut from gold lamé and flowed like liquid over the mannequin. It had a fluted train
and was clasped round the middle by a rhinestone belt with a butterfly-shaped buckle. The most eye-catching part of the design, however, was the sleeves. They were a confection of swirls and pleats, each one wrapped in a wreath of material so intricately twisted it coiled round the fabric like a vine. It was the kind of dress Karen knew visitors would imagine springing into life once their backs were turned. "Do you see the card, Lottie?" This dress was made by House Elfman, the fashion house Grandma Lisa's parents owned, the one that she grew up in. Remember I told you about that, and how clever your grandma was with a needle? Opa Michael always says sleeves were her speciality. This dress could be one of hers. Lottie smiled at the mention of her grandfather. She adored both Opa England and Opa Michael, as she called them, and they had shed years and the last traces of their old resentments with the little girl's birth.
"Why is that in there?"
Lottie pointed to a porcelain doll propped in the corner of the case, dressed in a miniature version of the gold gown.
"That's the really special bit. The museum staff let me put it in there. It's for the other Lottie, the one you were named for."
Lottie patted the glass as if she were stroking the doll's blonde hair.
"Your big sister who went to heaven?"
Karen nodded. "The doll and the dress are here because her story, and Grandma's, is one of the stories that this museum was built to remember." Lottie turned to her mother, her eyes bright as diamonds in the dimmed hall. She wrinkled her nose in such a perfect imitation of Lisa, Karen's heart fluttered. Depending on her daughter's mood, Karen could see traces of all of them in her heart-shaped face. Andrew and Lisa, Michael and Marcus, herself. More and more, however, as Lottie grew, Karen could see the strongly defined and separate character the 7-year-old was already becoming.
"Do you think I could be like her?"
Karen frowned.
"Like Grandma Lisa? Do you think I could make dresses as beautiful as that when I'm big?"
Karen reached for her daughter at the same time as Marcus's arms encircled her. She couldn't trust herself to speak. All the pain that had marked the past had finally been laid to rest. Now it was time to look back and find the good, to feel her family stretching forward and stretching back, part of the same whole, to know that her Lottie would have the childhood Lisa had dreamed of for both her girls, not filled with secrets and silences, but light and laughter and a safe place in the world. All the things Karen could give her child because, in this newly woven family that united all the strands that had been her mother's and father's lives and the countries that had shaped them, she had finally found them for herself. Karen leaned back into Marcus's arms and held her daughter tight, knowing that her mother and her sister were there, inside their embrace, knowing that the past was finally at one with the present, no longer a burden, but a part of them all, to be treasured and carried into a future founded on hope. If you were gripped by what only we know, why not try the fortunate ones? When Inga and Felix lock eyes across a crowded dance hall, it's love at first sight. But the next time they see each other, it will be across the packed courtyard of a Nazi concentration camp. Available in audio now. This has been What Only We Know, written by Catherine Hokin. Copyright 2020 by Catherine Hokin. Production copyright 2020 by Bookacher.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.